Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Historically, a supernova bright enough to see with the naked eye goes off about once a century. To be that bright, the supernova needs to be close enough. It needs to explode within the Milky Way. Those used to be the only supernovae ever detected. It would look like a new super bright star that would last for a month or so. The oldest claims are from Chinese astronomers all the way back in the 2nd century. But one of the most famous naked-eye supernovae was observed by the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe in 1572. Another one was observed just 32 years later by Johannes Kepler, a German astronomer and some might say the first astrophysicist. He is the astronomer who first discovered what we now call Kepler's laws of planetary motion. But let's get back to supernovae. These two particular supernovae changed our perspective on the nature of the universe. Before they were discovered, the distant stars were thought to be a sort of permanent background, an unchanging backdrop of constellations that the planets moved across. Now, with these supernova observations, it started to become apparent that the distant stars were not fixed in time. Things actually happened in the heavens. The universe changes over time. New stars are born, old ones die, and they can die quite dramatically. These two supernovae started humanity's path towards understanding our universe as the constantly evolving system that it is. And here's something you might find interesting. We haven't seen a naked-eye supernova since Kepler's supernova in 1604. We got two of them about 30 years apart, and then nothing for the past 400 years. So some people say we're overdue. The closest we got was in 1987 with a supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a small satellite galaxy that orbits the Milky Way, visible from the southern hemisphere, but I would love to see a naked-eye supernova in my lifetime. Our guest today works on many of the things that change with time in the universe. It's a field we call time domain astronomy. His name is Dr. Dan Milisavljevic, and we are going to talk with him about supernovae and what sort of forensic science we can do to learn about the stars that died to produce these incredible explosions. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. All right, are you ready to get started?
I'm super ready.
Awesome. I'm glad. The acoustics in here are great. I interviewed Ashley Villar in here. I don't know if I told you that. I think I did. But anyway, good. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Dan Milisavljevic, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University. Dr. Milisavljevic, thank you for joining me on my little podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Paul.
And I'm going to start this podcast with a little bit of honesty, which is the first time, it was maybe, it may have been 6 months ago, I asked you to do this podcast, and we sat down, and we had a great conversation, and the recorder didn't record a word of it. So I'm going to say I appreciate you sitting down with me again. I'm the only one who got to enjoy that episode.
Did too.
So some of the questions, I'll basically be asking you very similar questions, and we'll have to pretend like you haven't.
Paul, at my age, I'm forgetting things the day after, so good. It's all right. Distant memory to me. It's going to be all new, basically, for this podcast.
Excellent. Well, that all works out. Now, I'm trying to remember.
Wait, are you sure you're recording right now?
I'm pretty much never sure of that, but as sure as I can be.
Okay, I'll shut up. Go ahead.
Do you remember when we first met? I don't. I'm trying to remember.
Years.
It would have been years ago. I mean, I know I met you when I interviewed here, but I feel like we knew each other before then. Maybe it was at like a AAS meeting.
That's
of the
what
American
comes
Astronomical
to mind.
Society. We'd cross mm-hmm. paths there. So I actually some of my guests I'd known since I was a grad student, but I actually haven't known you quite as long. But we're now because we're both professors here, we got to know each other pretty well. So let me get started by talking a little bit about you. So let's start by asking, where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up in a modest-sized town called Stony Creek, Ontario.
Stony Creek, Ontario.
Yes,
in
I'm
Canada.
From the Great White North of Canada.
Nice.
That's right. That is a kind of suburb of Hamilton, Ontario, which is about an hour outside of Toronto, which some people might be familiar
right,
with.
Right. Right. Okay.
Hamilton is known as Hammertown. It's also known as Steel City. There's a large steel manufacturing businesses there.
Okay. And so that was where you grew up. So what was it like growing up there? I guess it was, that's, whenever somebody answers the question by saying it's a suburb of this other place I haven't heard of, that's usually suggests to me that that's kind of small town life, right?
You know, first thing that comes to mind of life as a child was bikes, bicycles. We would bicycle everywhere. So I remember a lot of exploration in that regard.
Right.
I could list off all sorts of memories of what I did, but exploration in that regard and some nerdy things like computer camp every so often.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So do you, okay, so does that, maybe that leads me to like, okay, you're talking about computer camp already and nerd, you were already like, how you were, how early was that when you were a kid? Like maybe like fourth grade or something like that?
From the get-go,
right.
My mom would be happy to bring out many pictures and articles starting from kindergarten that, you know, put me on a path towards something science-related later in life.
So do you have, how far back can you go? Do you have a memory of, the first time you, got interested in science? Or any, early memory of,
The memory that sticks out most to me is an assignment that was given to me in grade two. It was the solar system. And I remember the Duotang. Do you call it that in the U.S.? No, it's a folder, I guess, yeah. let's see, I'm using language that I grew up with and then hasn't transposed over yet. But there was a page for every planet, and I vividly remember coloring a cover page for each of the planets, and then I had a couple pages of a description of each one. And the whole process was incredible to me. The time I spent going to the local library to look up encyclopedias and books about each of the planets, the time taken to condense the information and put it into a couple pages. I'm making it sound like it's a published journal article or something, but I really reveled in that experience, that process of learn about this and then go find out and, you know, run some.
So when you were a kid, so that was second grade or something like that?
Second grade, yes.
And so what, okay, let me ask, what was your favorite planet then?
Everybody's planet, that favorite planet at that point would have been Pluto, of course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, mine was Saturn. My favorite
the
was
rings?
Saturn.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I gotta love those rings. So you like Pluto.
Sure.
You were cheering for the underdog. But so what was, now do you have a favorite planet now?
Oh,
is
no.
Is it different or
no,
is it the same?
No, I love them all.
You love
yeah, yeah. I'm gonna,
that's not like what my mom would say when we asked who her favorite kid
child.
Was.
That's right.
you have a secret favorite, I know it. But you love all the planets. They're all great.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I have a special connection, if I can phrase it that way, with Uranus and Neptune, just because I helped find moons around those planets.
Oh.
I helped to find. Let me be extremely clear. I helped
you didn't
to find. No,
Dan
it was not me at the telescope pointing in that direction. Look there.
Discovering a moon.
No. I was an undergraduate at the time. I was part of a larger effort. And I spent hours and hours and hours examining images. One of them turned out to be a planet, and I got to name it. So Ferdinand, that orbits around Uranus,
got to name?
I named Ferdinand.
You got to name a moon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's very cool. So if I asked you which your favorite moon was,
it's Ferdinand. Yeah.
That would have been an easy question. All right. So, okay. Going back then, do you think, do you think your parents were big influences on science? You said your mom was always getting you into, or has pictures of you being a nerd when you were a little kid, but obviously sent you to space camp, and or not space camp, computer camp.
Right.
I assumed it was space camp because of Astro, but Anyway.
So, my parents didn't push me towards science specifically, mm-hmm. but from them I learned the kind of core elements that you needed to conduct science, which is a great work ethic and ability to work in teams, right? Mm-hmm. So they were always enabling me to be able to pursue the things that I wanted. And I can't explain why, but for some reason I was always gravitated to these kinds of things. So computer camp in mm-hmm. like grade okay. 8 or 7 or
so
something.
You'd see something I'd for it say that, like,
Mom, I
want
to do it.
Yeah.
And she'd always be very good. And one thing, she was always clear, Danny, any books, sorry, I'm using my mom's voice, I read, but any books that I wanted, she mm-hmm. was always happy to buy them for me. Huh. So that was those kinds of things. If I saw opportunities that I wanted to take advantage of,
right.
she'd find a way. And, you know, both my parents immigrated from the former Yugoslavia. They came over with very little money. They're working shift work the whole time. It's mm-hmm. not as though we were very well off, but she prioritized these kinds of experiences for me, so I'm always grateful for that.
Did your dad work in the steel industry?
That's right. Okay. That's right. DeFasco okay. Steel. Yeah, that's
okay.
right. Yeah.
Wow. So they. So they basically looked for up when one of their kids was curious about something, they'd seize the opportunity.
Yeah. If my sister was here, she'd say it was very unfair that I got more spoils than she did.
I see. Sounds like, well, I don't have to guess. I know you were the young one.
Yes, yes.
The youngest.
Yes.
But so youngest gets more stuff. That's just how it goes.
She got some cool stuff later in life too, so I think it's all worked out.
So then, what about astrophysics got you, like, you know, you said computer camp and stuff, and like other, like, obviously early on you wanted to do, you did this thing on planets, so obviously it was exciting to you early on, but what about astrophysics sort of drove you in that direction?
So, I actually had a detour in life. Mm-hmm. Following undergrad, I actually thought I didn't want to do astrophysics.
Okay.
So, actually, it relates back to this moon mission. Let's call it that. I like that.
Okay, good.
The moon mission. So, the work that went into it, it was day in, day out, 8 to 10 hours as a summer REU student,
okay.
looking at thousands of images, blinking through them. There was a pipeline at the time that mm-hmm. would parse through and find candidates, but of course there's bugs in it. And, mm-hmm. and at this point, even today, but especially back then, it was more so you needed to have human eyes look at it and parse through and run some scripts, etc.
Right.
So it was a solid, you know, multiple months of looking at thousands of images, and I said, if this is astronomy, it's not for me. I'm getting out of this thing.
Right.
So it was at that point that I went to my other interest in life, philosophy. So I went to the London School of Economics. I got some award thing to be able to go to London School of Economics for a year for a master's in the history and philosophy of science. So I went in that route.
Mm.
And that was very captivating. If you've talked a bit about quantum mechanics on the show, or if people are familiar, one of the weird, wild things with quantum mechanics is it has these probabilities, and we don't know if it's reflecting our ignorance of a deeper nature that's inaccessible, or is the universe really working probabilities, right?
Right.
Which is, like, Einstein found really hard to believe.
Right.
Maybe that's the case. My master's thesis was trying to understand, why is that? Is there something deeper going on, and what are ways that we can interpret
right.
understanding? Anyway, so then I spent a year in that, and I went to some symposia and conferences, and that was terrible. It was a bunch of old men arguing past each other, and the challenge with that field is there's no real movement forward, because
right.
Any theory has a formalism and an interpretation, and the formalism remains solid, okay, that's the equations, and then there's the interpretation that you put on top of that.
Right.
And that's what they were arguing, the interpretation, but there's
right.
no way to prove one versus another.
Right.
right. So it happened to be that the year that I went to London School of Economics, I had a deferred acceptance to Dartmouth College. So a kid not knowing what to do, figuring philosophy isn't free, I went to Dartmouth College. And I explored other interests potentially in condensed matter. But ultimately, getting back to your question, I'm sorry, but ultimately, I was a teaching assistant for an astronomy class. I got along very well with the lead instructor, Professor Robert Fiesen.
Okay.
Ultimately ended up being my PhD supervisor. He took me observing to a professional observatory for the first time. And that is when I had my aha moment.
So you were like an undergrad who was kind of like thought science was cool, but you weren't sure if you this like it seemed like your research experience in it found it really tedious, and then you had also had you were like maybe philosophy, and then that had its own, and then now finally you were taken to a telescope, and you're like, okay, this is astronomy.
Yes. So this is something that I think about a lot as an advisor for students now.
Mm-hmm.
One, to try and not give them projects that make them want to leave the field, but maybe it's they can go do a walkabout.
Mm-hmm.
But then also realizing that each path is different, and that's why being exposed to various opportunities gives you a sense of maybe, oh, this is what I want to do, right?
Well, that's definitely true. Yeah. It's funny you talked about philosophy. I had, you know, when I was a grad student at NYU, one of the professors there was, you know, I think he was, you know, emeritus, and at that point you're free to study like weird, you know, philosophy of quantum
mechanics. I hope
mechanics.
To get there one day,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Like, you don't have to work on anything that's going to get a result. You can just do it. And he gave a little talk about it, and he was like, you know, you may wonder, like, you know, it's been like a century since these questions first came up and why there hasn't been any progress on them. Well, for philosophers, a century is nothing, right? We have things we've been debating for, like, thousands of years. And we haven't made any progress, you know. So, you know, that's just sort of how it is. Some people are into that. Some people want to like talk about the big questions we just don't have scientific ways of exploring, and we just have to argue at each other for a long time.
Yeah, and to be clear, I got a lot of value out of that time. So philosophers argue a lot. So I learned a lot about the argumentative process, how to analyze somebody's opinion and then be able to deconstruct it.
I find that interesting because people think of philosophy as like a totally useless skill, but it's really where you learn the most core foundations of how you debate something. Like,
absolutely.
So anyway, that's very cool. This isn't the philosophy podcast, though. But I mean, I guess it could be. But anyway, so... So now you're an astrophysicist. Maybe I should just back up here, because then I want a little bit about grad school. Because you were excited about telescopes. You had Rob Fiesen showing you these things, and then you ended up being his PhD student. Is there a point where you feel like you learned how to be a scientist? Like,
I would have to write down and do a chronology to think about the point that it happened.
Yes.
But certainly it was the years of being a graduate student that I really felt becoming more and more confident as a scientist.
Right.
And Rob Fiesen, he's got a lot of one-liners. And one of them he would often joke is how the grad student ahead of me, he knew that the student was ready to move on to the next stage, like a proper scientist, when it was the student coming and correcting the advisor, right?
Oh,
so,
yes.
Chris Girardi, I knew it was time for him to go when he came to me with the ideas and he was correcting what I was saying, right? So I reached that threshold at some point, and that's when that provided me the confidence that I'd be able to go on and do my own project.
Right, you're not just doing what someone else is telling you.
Right,
you're,
right.
You're
that's one of the biggest things I try to mold with the students that I work with is that I'm really just a mentor, and you should be developing your own skill set. You don't want to just wait for me to constantly be giving you ideas.
Yeah. In my group, I end up being, well, my group, I think, gets that stage quickly because I'm kind of a space cadet, and I often don't know what I'm
good
talking
strategy.
About. And they'll just kind of be like, "All right, well, I think that's wrong." They get there very quickly. So now you're an astrophysicist. What do you like the most about your job?
I love there's so many components, but One, I do love actually using a telescope. That is, even if it's my rinky-dink 11-inch telescope that I have for home, who my wife doesn't think is rinky-dink, by the way, but most professional astronomers would stick up their nose at it. But the idea of handling a telescope, of pointing it at the stars, and recording photons that have come from, you know, light years away.
Yes.
Thousands, millions, billions of light years away sometimes.
Well, not your telescope, maybe.
Not in my telescope.
Billions, but.
But in others, yes. Yeah. So the act of using, and then the portion where I share that information. Mm-hmm. I'd like to joke that I feel sometimes like I'm a reporter of the universe. So sometimes I'm out there on my gig and I see something potentially for the first time. There's a data set that have come in, and I'm the first to look at it, and I get to evaluate, analyze, see if there's anything interesting, and then there might be like, huh, that's funny kind of moment that translates into a paper. And so that whole process of being able to write it up and share it with people is very rewarding.
Yeah. That's very cool. I mean, I don't get to have that aspect because I mostly do theory, so I don't get to be a reporter. I mostly just say what I think the paper is going to say tomorrow, and it's not right.
right, and that's the wonderful role that complementary that we have.
Yeah,
I won't be able to understand the "huh, that's funny" kind of thing, right? Without some kind of framework.
Yeah,
right. That the theorist that can provide for me, because that's the data get taken, and then next thing I do is I'm on the NASA ADS bibliography system to try and figure out some theory paper that predicted this or to try some find some framework to understand what I'm seeing.
So
how does it actually work then for you? You have a just a kind of moment, I want to explore something, or maybe observations encourage you to pursue?
It's a lot of different things, because it's usually ideas spring out of other ideas. So like I'll write a paper, I'll have written a paper, but in the process of that I will be like, oh, I didn't try this, but I didn't want to do that for this paper, or someone will, there will be an observation that I'll see that, like a new observation people are trying to understand, and I have something, some insight I think I can give, or, something I can try. But yeah, I mean, I think a large percentage of my ideas come from other, previous papers I wrote, and, thinking about when I was in the process of that, thinking about what other things I could have done. But yeah, I don't get to have the same sort of, just looking at things and trying to find something interesting. So it is a different, process, but I mean, there's, I guess, a similar mindset to it, I think, is just keeping your mind open to things that somebody might find interesting.
Absolutely, that's something we share. This is part of the reason why we collectively read papers as part of the journal club that you read, right? So you get ideas from seeing new things happening. Yep.
All right, so I asked, those are the types of things you like about your job. Was there anything you don't like about your job?
The thing that I don't like is I just don't have enough time to do everything that I do like. So, and it comes with any job that is associated with some level of administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. But I think, the problems that I face are the inability to keep up with all the interests from students, with all the ideas that I have.
Right.
So that's the challenge, is to manage that input-output.
I see. So you don't... there's not enough hours in your day to spend on your job. It's the thing you don't like about it.
I never thought of it that way, Paul.
All right. So it sounds like you really like being an astrophysicist.
Absolutely. I tell my wife all the time, greatest job in the universe.
I love it. I mean, it's a greater job than I could have imagined having, so I'm really happy about it. But... all right, what do you think, what would you say was the most challenging part of getting to where you are in academia, or?
There are many directions to go in that. The first word that comes up is perseverance.
Mm-hmm.
So to get where I'm sitting right now took a lot of perseverance, along with luck, along with support.
Yeah.
I'm almost getting into a very serious tone here, but getting an academic job can be hard.
Yeah.
Can be hard. And there's a lot of chance as and timing as far as what's hot for any specific field at any given time.
That's right.
What jobs may be available at any given time and place.
Right.
Certain people may have geographic restrictions, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't directly address. The most challenge was just being able to get the assistant professor position to begin with. So I went through, I was able to get into grad school, and then I was lucky enough to be able to get a postdoc and then another postdoc after that.
Hmm.
But there comes a point at which you have to transition to become an actual professor,
right?
And find that.
And then, the number of jobs available is just tiny compared to how many people want these jobs, because they are, like you said, greatest job in the universe. So. There's lots of people clamoring for these jobs.
Yes.
And they're really smart people, really highly qualified, intelligent people that you're competing against. So, yeah, all kinds of things matter. Luck matters. The fact that when you said hot topic, it's such a big thing. It's like when they hire you, they're like, is this person going to be, relevant, 10 years from now? This thing, that stuff they work on, is that the stuff that people are going to care about, And that what we care about changes from like year to year. So it's really, it just happens to be that year, gravitational waves are in the spotlight, and then suddenly lots of people with, doing work on that get jobs.
Yeah. I'll say a couple things. One is, here I am today, but I could see myself equally happy and responding the same way. I have the best job in the universe doing something else if I had gone a different path.
Sure. And
so things just worked out in a way that I'm here today, which is splendid. One thing that kept me motivated, oddly enough, was something that Conan O'Brien, another podcaster, said, which is
he's
silly.
My big competitor. Is that... I'm gonna take
Conan
him down.
Asked me this morning. I said no. I got Paul Duffel booked. Sorry.
Oh, I'm glad you made the right choice.
So if you recall, he had that dream job of the Tonight Show, but then they took it away from him. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm a little bit familiar with it.
Anyway, and one of the things he said in the closing night is some words of wisdom, which was, do your best work, be nice to people, and good things will happen. And I think that is a great kind of broad strokes approach to things,
right?
So I did do my best work whenever I could.
Right.
And whatever I do, task I have, I try to do my best work.
Mm-hmm.
And then just be nice to people, too.
Okay? Yeah.
I bring this up to students because they can be very impressionable and they can watch people ahead of them. I was in environments, we've overlapped in certain institutions and stuff. And you can see, you're recruiting from the human race. Okay?
Right.
So you can, behaviors are copied across the board, even in astrophysics, and there are opportunities presented to you where you could, be not so nice, to try and,
in order to get ahead quickly.
In order to get ahead.
Yeah.
So I've always reflected and try to do the path that is the right path, that is, takes into consideration people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then good things will follow. And so far, that's worked out pretty well for me.
But as you said, even if you hadn't got an academic job, that would still have been the right choice to me to do good work. be nice to people.
Absolutely. I know I've had many students and postdocs that have gone on to other positions. One's at Northrop Grumman, for instance, you know, doing very well and very happy there. There's so many things that you may want out of life that an academic position isn't accommodating to.
Right. Oh, definitely. That's definitely true.
Yeah. It's not always a 9-to-5 job, for instance. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's true. That's one big thing with academics is it isn't, like, for most of us, you know, it's very hard. You know, some people try to treat it like 9-to-5 job, but ultimately it's not. You ultimately are always kind of, you'll be thinking about it while you know, and in your dreams, you know.
One thing, actually, going back to the steel factory, so I worked in DeFasco for a summer. I did shift work. I got up at, the shifts went from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. or from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m., 12-hour shifts. It would be 3 days on, 3 days off, 2 days on, 2 days off. And it was crazy. I was in the blast furnace where they would, like, make the steel, and they would be huge torpedoes and hot. I had to wear a suit where I put long johns on underneath because it was so hot it could burn through the outer layer of my overalls. And I had to get special boots because the soles could melt with a standard plastic sole. Yeah. Anyway, why am I talking about this? But in that case, the job truly was you go there, you do the work, and you just leave it. You don't have to think about it
anymore.
That's
right. That's right.
I'm off shift. I punched out.
That's right.
I can just explore what I want. Right.
Yeah.
And there's some.
So a lot of people. No, yeah. And there is an intangible benefit that, like, you know, if you have that in your life, it's, you know, understand that that's not everybody gets that. And so it's a nice. It is an advantage of a lot of that, you know. A lot of jobs can provide that academia doesn't really provide, but it all depends on your personality, right? What you prefer. Okay, so we should probably get into talking about what your actual research that you do now.
Sure.
So let me ask you this: when you meet a new grad student or fellow scientist, and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
Sure. I say I do time domain astrophysics, and I specialize in understanding supernovae and supernova remnants.
Okay. So when you say time domain astrophysics, what is that? How, break that phrase down for us.
It means things changing in the sky broadly.
Mm-hmm.
There's many phenomena in the universe that change in human time scales.
Right.
Right. And the ones I'm interested in are explosions, mm-hmm. generally stellar explosions, mm-hmm. massive star explosions.
So in time domain, meaning like you can look back at the thing multiple times and it'll look different. Like, for example, a supernova will get bright and then it'll get dim again.
That's right. Actually, sorry, you're doing a great job mm-hmm. in like making it accessible for everybody. Exactly. So we've moved as a community away from, I'm going to take one image of the entire sky,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be my reference mm-hmm. for decades, to recognizing that it changes.
Mm-hmm.
So constantly mapping the sky,
mm-hmm.
and then using the power of computers to be able to rapidly compare one image against another to look mm-hmm. for those changes.
Right.
And then doing that in multiple filters, which just means different colors of light that mm-hmm. the camera will be sensitive to in any given filter, and doing that repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. And so then, yeah, searching the sky for any changes, anything that's different, and then that could be all kinds of things. In your case, the thing you'd be looking for is these bright transient events like supernovae, but other things you've worked on. Why don't I ask, what do you feel like is like your most impactful results, or the thing that, I don't know, you're most proud of, or think that, you know, want to tell people the most about? That's really what the question is.
Well, I think I've kind of peaked in my career. So the thing that I'm most proud of now is the work that we've done with the James Webb Space Telescope. And maybe multiple people on this podcast or elsewhere have said that, but that really is. It's hard not for that to be the most biggest thing that I've done
mm-hmm.
Because it is a transformational facility. I'm so lucky that I'm in a stage of my career that I could use it, and I was able to build up a team to be able able to, you know, gain access to it and extract as much science as possible from the data. So I was a principal investigator for Cycle 1, so that was among the first data that were taken from James Webb Space Telescope for a supernova remnant. So this is a star that exploded about 350 years ago in our Milky Way galaxy.
Why don't we slow down?
Yeah,
now?
Yeah, so, I'm so getting too excited.
So, that's fine. So you were among the first people to get access to James Webb and the James Webb Telescope anyways. And you had it point at the thing called a supernova remnant.
Yes.
And a supernova remnant is let's explain that in like a little bit more detail.
Right. Well, we use the term supernova. So this is a star that does this implosion explosion scenario. And I'm a faithful listener of your podcast, and I know you've covered supernovae in the past. Mm-hmm. Okay? So at some point, massive stars that are about 10 times the mass of the sun undergo this tremendously energetic explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a blast wave and we have the stellar, the debris that expands into space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, teaser alert, that expansion will continue for hundreds of thousands to a million years, and it'll seed the interstellar space with all the raw materials for new stars and planets around those stars to form.
Right.
If you rewind the clock and you go to years, decades, centuries after the explosion, okay,
yes,
there's opportunities to see the gas minimally disturbed by its interaction with the surrounding environment.
Okay, so what people normally, when people get to see a supernova in the sky, which our generation of humanity hasn't really gotten to see like a bright naked eye supernova like some generations have, but it's like it's this bright thing that it gets bright for a few weeks and gets dim again.
If it's naked eye, it could be months
that's true.
Yeah.
But typical supernovae, what we look through telescopes to see.
That's right.
They get bright and then a few weeks later they get dim again. And so that's the part we normally call the supernova, because that's the thing usually the thing that we see. But then much later, as is the thing, 100 years later, 1,000 years later, this thing, it's still expanding out, and this explosion is still expanding out into the surrounding gas and dust that's around it. And you're saying then we can actually get a picture of it, which is what you did.
That's right. That's a great explanation. That's right. Yeah.
So we pointed the James Webb Telescope at, or you, well, chose, well, we, I guess, but you, I didn't do anything.
I
you,
filled out the computer script that was sent to Space Telescope that was reviewed by somebody that then at some point uploaded it to the spacecraft.
Right,
that's
right. And then it pointed at this supernova remnant, which is called
Cassiopeia A.
Cassiopeia
A for short, just rolls off the tongue a little bit more easily.
Yes.
Now, other telescopes had looked at it before. The Hubble Space Telescope, for instance.
Okay.
And if listeners could view what's happening right now, right above me, is a Hubble Space Telescope of Cassay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the motivation to look at it again with a new telescope, in this case James Webb, was because there is a lot of new information that can be revealed by looking at it in the infrared. Hubble is sensitive to ultraviolet and optical. James Webb is near to mid-infrared. And because it's expanded so much, the gas is traveling 10,000 kilometers per second.
Yes.
It slows down as it continues to expand, and it cools. It cools to temperatures that emit in the infrared.
Okay.
So that's why we want to look at it with the James Webb Space Telescope.
So the idea is, well, one basic point is, like, I mean, I always say, like, well, you have this new telescope that's way more advanced. The Hubble was made in the 90s. So you might as well, like, in my head, I'm always like, well, you might as well just point it at this really new telescope. It's going to be way more, you know, it's going to get a way nicer image of it regardless. But you're also saying it's also in another band that is relevant for Cassiopeia and presumably other supernova remnants.
Exactly. A large portion of my science is trying to understand the story of the star that was there before.
Mm-hmm.
What type of star was it, and how did it explode? The physics behind the core collapse process.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do that, I want to access the gas that's closest to the explosion center.
Mm-hmm.
And this is gas that's cool, not hip cool, but temperature cool.
Uh-huh.
And it's emitting only in the mid-infrared.
Okay.
Okay. We don't see it in an HST image,
okay,
for instance.
So when HST, the Hubble Space Telescope, when it sees it, it mostly sees this gas that's, this hot gas that's colliding, where the supernova is colliding with the surrounding medium, and then that's producing this hot gas.
Yes.
That was most of what we see with Hubble.
Yes.
But then you're saying, James Webb, we're seeing stuff inside, deeper inside the supernova.
And just a little bit of physics here, shock physics, but to really appreciate the beauty of the James Webb image, the supernova shock wave runs into surrounding medium. Okay, that blast, that forward blast wave, then kind of, you know, it sweeps up material, and in response, there's what we call reverse shock. It's
mm-hmm.
a shock that's moving in another direction, opposite to it in that framework. This reverse shock is what we see in the optical. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And that gets it really hot.
Yes.
The collision, and then that sends these X-ray UV photons that go in the inside and light it up in the infrared. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to see it.
Okay, so the collision of this this supernova with the surrounding gas creates these shocks that make the gas hot, and then
yes.
those produce light, the photons that go inward,
yes.
deeper into it, that scatter off of material in the core, in deeper inside of
right.
the supernova remnant, and then we can see that
right.
with James Webb that
right.
we couldn't see with Hubble.
Exactly, and I think people can appreciate, if I want to understand how a bomb exploded,
mm-hmm.
I want to look at, you know, the stuff that's closest to where that mm-hmm. ignition center was.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. So that's very cool. So then, I guess what I mean. So, you know, you, of course, like you said, you're a big fan of Cassiopeia A. You worked on it a lot. And so what are the big things that have come out of it, or that we've learned either with Hubble or with James Webb? Like, what are some of the big exciting? Are there any major discoveries that you can point to?
So why I'm so proud about the James Webb
mm-hmm.
images is that now we've been able to create a map of
mm-hmm.
the unshocked ejecta. That's what
mm-hmm.
I call it, the cool stuff that,
mm-hmm.
not hip cool, but it is hip cool. Back to that joke. But the detail that James Webb has provided, okay, is unmatched. We had some hints of it before.
Mm-hmm.
There was another infrared telescope called Spitzer.
Mm-hmm.
But now the detail is such that we can test computer simulations of the core collapse process to try
yes.
and reproduce the distribution. Okay.
Yeah.
And broader strokes. Okay. The information that provides of understanding the dynamics of the explosion process, of how
mm-hmm.
the heavy radioactive material, nickel 56 and
mm-hmm.
various others, gets mixed. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That mixing is very important in understanding the integrated light that we'll see if it were in an extragalactic supernova.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me rephrase that. The information that CASS-A provides is a vital calibration for interpreting supernovae that are distant,
right.
okay? That are extragalactic,
right.
that are point sources,
right.
that the time domain astrophysics people are interested in,
right.
that those are doing Rubin Observatory
that's
work.
Right. So most supernovae we don't see as remnants, because the remnants are the ones that are close to us that we can get a picture of.
Yes.
And we can actually get a nice image of. But the most of them are these, we just see this thing getting bright and then dimming. Maybe we get a spectrum of it, but we don't get a three-dimensional distribution of where all of the material is. And right. So with Cassay, we can actually right. do that.
I mean, it's a bad analogy, but I'll use it anyway. Try to imagine understanding somebody's physiology, their you know, what's happening with them internally by just taking images on the outside, right? So what a remnant investigation allows you to do is to do a dissection, to actually look inside the stellar explosion.
Right.
In three dimensions.
Right.
So there's a lot of talk about understanding the earliest stages of the universe, mm-hmm. when galaxies were first forming with mm-hmm. the first stars. If we're going to have any hope of understanding that kind of physics and the supernovae associated with that, we need to have a very solid understanding of what's happening nearby.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point I always come to. Because there's so much hype built up about, oh, universe breakers, these galaxies are too massive, physics is broken. No. Okay. Let's make sure we understand.
I hope Erica listens to this episode.
So there is a lot of explanation, and it's actually coming out in the literature mm-hmm. now, various ways, star formation, the types of stars
right.
and such. Just bringing it back to our understanding of that distant phenomena
right.
hinges on our ability to understand, you know, the products of supernovae that are made nearby. So the elements, the distribution,
right.
the amount of dust they produce.
Right. So what you're saying is an important part of the evolution of galaxies is supernova
yes.
going off in these galaxies.
Yes.
Because inside of stars, you know, they're busy forging all these heavy elements, and then during that their supernova explosion, they forge even heavier elements, and those get flung out and enrich the galaxy, and bring all these elements that are other than hydrogen and helium, which are basically formed in the Big Bang. But everything else, those are then there's other processes that, but the big one is supernovae that really enriches the galaxy with all the with the middle of the periodic table with stuff that we're all made out of. And so if we want to understand the earliest galaxies, how they got to where they are, we really, really have to have a good handle on, well, what sort of products do these supernovae actually make, and in what distribution, and how do we interpret the supernova that we don't have this nice three-dimensional reconstruction of.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
exactly.
How many? I don't actually know. This is good. I don't actually know the answer to this question. How many supernova remnants have we cataloged in the Milky Way?
If you include the Magellanic Clouds, we're at about 400.
About 400.
Yes.
Okay. Total in all of human history.
Yes. Yes. And as I made a point in a recent proposal, the James Webb Telescope has only looked at three of them.
Only three.
Yes.
So we've seen Cassay.
Yes.
See, we've seen the Crab
Nebula. And supernova 1987A.
87A.
Which is
right.
arguably a remnant, but we'll include it.
It's
yes.
not hundreds of years later.
That's
it's
right.
1987 to today. So,
yeah.
But it's nearby enough that we can get a good image of it. So, but that's it so far, and with James Webb anyways. But Hubble has looked at a number of these.
Yes.
But there's potentially hundreds we could look at.
Correct.
So that's a very exciting
A lot of opportunity there.
Yeah.
Anybody on the TAC that's listening, a lot of opportunity.
Great. All right, let me ask you this. In your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics? I know we kind of jumped into a very big question.
Well, it's such an easy question to me.
Yeah?
I get it asked to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll summarize like this. It's fun, and it allows us an opportunity to understand our place in the history and future of the universe.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me borrow an expression from Kurt Vonnegut, mm-hmm. an Indiana writer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're all just farting around till we die. So, and that's the quotation. Then I'll extrapolate. You know, what are you going to do with it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you want to play sports. right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to do a hobby of knitting or, you know, woodwork. Maybe you want to play video games. Maybe, there's so many things that you can be doing while you're, you know, on this planet. Why not spend some fraction of that time thinking about things beyond just our location here, beyond your city and country, and beyond the planet?
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Think about, as I said, our place in the universe, and maybe get some reward out of that. Okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with the Japanese aesthetic Yujin. I'm going to brutalize the translation, but I interpret it as, you know, moments when the universe is able to convey its immensity and beauty. So if you're thinking about a sunset, or, you know, walking in a forest and you see, look up and you see these majestic trees, mm-hmm. you kind of get a wow mm-hmm. moment, okay? Nobody's going to ask, why are you going for a walk in the forest? Or, are you crazy? That sunset, you know, why do you care about that? Okay? It's just, it's this cosmic connection, okay? Mm-hmm. But on a scale that's kind of familiar. Anybody can look at a sunset and appreciate it, mm-hmm. and look at the trees. Nobody can, it's not necessarily the case that you can look at a James Webb image or some other astro image or some other simulation result, mm-hmm. okay? And immediately understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of my role as an astrophysicist is to be able to help a wider community of people to have those kinds of Yujin moments, like looking at a sunset or majestic trees, when they look at some kind of astrophysical result.
Right.
Because it helps us understand, how precious it is that we are living at this moment of time in the entire history of the universe to be mm-hmm. able to appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good answer. It's interesting you mentioned that about sunsets. It reminded me, Abby Poland was telling me when she observed at Magellan in Chile. There's those species. They have some kind of species of rabbit. I don't remember what it's a rabbit-like creature. But every morning at sunrise and every evening at sunset, they all get up and line up and just stare at the sun. And then as soon as
the sun
sets,
oh my gosh, that's beautiful. Yes.
They don't need to do that for any evolutionary purpose or anything. They just want to look at the sun. It's
that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. When I was observing in Arizona, mm-hmm. some of the birds at sunset would mm-hmm. come and hover, and we were convinced that they were just watching the sunset, because mm-hmm. they would only that time of day that they would gather and start just hovering and watching the mm-hmm. sunset. Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. So what do you think? What do you think is the next big thing? Like, either, you know, what do you think is the next big thing you hope happens in your field, like in the next decade or so?
Oh, wow.
Or it's the next thing you want to do.
Oh, wow. Well, actually, speaking about Abby Poland, we just had a talk about Rubin Observatory. So mm-hmm. this is something that I've been waiting for a long time, as a lot of people. In our discussion about time domain astrophysics, this is the next generation instrument that's going to revolutionize opportunities. So mm-hmm. it's looking so far into the universe at this reasonable cadence, so how often it returns to a field and, mm-hmm. and images it again, it's going to enable us to go from this is an interesting supernova and we see it, you know, a handful of times, and mm-hmm. here's another one and, you know, we see it maybe once and mm-hmm. never see it again, the volume of space that it's going to probe is going to allow a lot more statistical analyses to be done on mm-hmm. the supernovae. And bottom line, given the variety of stellar systems that are out there that lead to supernova explosions, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what I study, you need to have as many examples as possible.
Yes.
Because it's not just single stars, there's two stars, and then how far away, how far apart they are, mm-hmm. Their relative mass ratios, their mm-hmm. metallicity, there's so many variables, okay? Mm-hmm. You need to have the numbers to be able to do a proper analysis.
So understanding the whole landscape of all what all types of supernova can be. When you only look at a handful, well, we have more than a handful, but like when you only look at so many, you really aren't getting a full picture of this, like the full landscape of what supernovae are.
Scratching the surface of greater science opportunities, yes.
All right. Well, that's great. So I think that's pretty good. So why don't I just thank you. Thank you, Dr. Emilia Savievich, for joining us. I'm really glad we got to sit down and talk about this, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
Anytime, Paul. This was a true delight. Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for the podcast. It's wonderful.
Thanks again, Dan. Some great food for thought about why we study the universe in the first place. I hope we get a chance to talk again soon. So thank you, Professor Emilia Savievich. And thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. Music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford from the album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Check out more of her music if you enjoyed it. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University.